Good afternoon, and welcome to today's conference call on the results of the Israeli elections. Here is your moderator, Mr. David Butler, Chair of JFNA's Israel and Overseas Committee.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our call on the Israeli elections, which has been organized by the Jewish Federations of North America and the Jewish Council for Public Affairs. As we all know, yesterday saw the culmination of 3 months of highly charged and often surprising politics in Israel when the national elections were held. Many of us were up pretty late last night watching the results and the returns. And while we now know which parties and individuals made it across most of the electoral threshold issues and into the Knesset, Israel now moves into what could be called the second stage when politicians compete to form a coalition by securing the support of a majority of the newly elected members of the Knesset. So we've got some questions. What can we expect in the coming weeks? What sort of government will we see? And who were the big winners and losers in yesterday's election? To address these topics, I'm pleased to welcome Lahav Harkov, who is a well-known Israeli journalist and political correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. Lahav, please enlighten us.
Sure. Thanks for having me on this call. We're sort of already in the coalition negotiations phase, even though the results of the election are not official yet. By tomorrow morning, Israel time, so I guess late at night, your time, we should have the official results after all of the mostly soldiers' votes, but there are, you know, diplomats and a few other categories of people whose votes are coming at the end. And that's about 3% of the votes. And it could shift things a bit. The big difference would maybe be for the New Right Party, led by Naftali Bennett and Ayala Shaked. They're below the electoral threshold, but they're actually very close. They need 4,000 more votes. And so they're watching these sort of soldiers' votes very closely to see if they're going to get in. Usually the Arab parties lose out once the soldiers' votes are counted. Like they lose a seat or two just because so few Israeli Arabs serve in the army that that's just not who people are voting for when you're counting votes from the army. So there'll be, you know, minor shifts in the makeup of the Knesset tomorrow or later today for you. Now, starting next week, sort of the next step in the process, the parties will start having meetings with President Rivlin. He, by law, is required to consult with representatives of every party that's getting into the Knesset. And within a week of the official results being published, so by next Thursday, Rivlin has to say who he is tasking with forming the next government. Now, in all likelihood, it'll be Netanyahu at this point. The law doesn't say he has to actually listen to the recommendations of the Knesset members, but historically that's what's always happened. And Rivlin has basically said that he plans to follow precedent. When I said coalition talks had already basically started, it's because Netanyahu is talking to what he calls his natural partners, the other right-wing parties, to see who's going to recommend him for, you know, to the president. And the leaders of those parties are already sort of presenting their demands of what they'll want when an eventual coalition is formed, even though theoretically that's supposed to only come after Rivlin's recommendation. So at the moment, most of the right-wing parties or the right-wing and Haredi parties have committed to recommending Netanyahu. So that's Shas, Unei Torah Judaism, the Union of Right-Wing Parties, which is what used to be known as BYUD, as well as the Kulanu Party. They've all committed to recommending Netanyahu. Yisrael Beiteinu, which is Victor Lieberman's party, they have not committed to it yet. Lieberman is playing hardball. He actually left the country today to go on vacation for a few days, which is a sort of tough negotiating tactic that he had used in the past. It's his way of saying he's not in Netanyahu's pocket. And I'm sure he's also enjoying himself wherever he's gone this time. But last time it was whitewater rafting in Eastern Europe. I have yet to find out what he's doing now. But Lieberman has made demands, and he said he'll only recommend Netanyahu if he gets the defense ministry again. As you may remember, he was defense minister. He resigned in November, and that was sort of part of – it's not what actually triggered this election, but it sort of set events into place that led to this election being held early. So he wants that, but he wants sort of freer rein to – set strategy for how to counter Hamas, because he resigned because he wanted, he wanted a much more sort of hawkish and proactive strategy against Hamas than Netanyahu wanted. So he's sort of demanding to be allowed to implement his ideas on how to fight Hamas. And he also wants to pass the Haredi enlistment law that he had brought forward. It's unclear what of those demands could actually happen. Netanyahu, or sources close to Netanyahu, really have indicated that Netanyahu actually really likes being defense minister for the past few months, and he might want to keep that portfolio. So we'll see what happens with that. Without Lieberman at the moment, Netanyahu only has 60 seats and not 61 for a majority, so he needs Lieberman. But it's possible, and in fact somewhat likely, that after the soldiers' votes are counted, that the right will go up a seat or two. In the last election, Meretz actually benefited from the soldier seats. It was Meretz and Likud who benefited, but it's hard to know at this point. So we'll find out in the morning, but more often than not, the right actually benefits from soldiers voting. So Netanyahu might not need Lieberman in the end, and he'll know soon enough whether he already has a majority sort of in the bag. After Rivlin tasks, presumably it would be Netanyahu with forming the government, I'll go back to why presumably it is. Really, Gantz does not have anywhere near a majority. So when people talk about the right and the left-wing bloc, so they say the right is 65 seats and the left is 55 seats. But the left is really smaller than that, because the Arab parties on principle never join any coalition. They're ideologically opposed to sort of being part of any Israeli government, because they oppose the idea sort of Israel being a Jewish state, because they oppose Israel's presence in the West Bank. People often will count the Arab parties in the left-wing bloc, but they really, it doesn't really make sense, because the chances of them joining a coalition are almost zero. It's never happened, and they haven't indicated that they're changing their mind. So once Netanyahu is tasked with forming the government, he has 28 days to negotiate, and he can ask for an extension of up to 14 more days. So we are basically 7 weeks before the deadline to form a government. Things look like they could go faster than that, but on the other hand, sometimes, as a negotiation strategy, people do like to draw things out, make Netanyahu sweat so that he starts giving things up for him. And when there are a lot of different parties in the coalition, and Netanyahu needs them all in order to have a majority, then it's a lot easier for them to sort of extract more and more senior ministries from Netanyahu. So, what happens with these soldiers' votes is actually a pretty big deal, because if the new right gets in, then Netanyahu will be less dependent on the parties that are smaller, which would be New Right, Israel Beiteinu, and Kulanu, in the sense that they won't be able to get as much out of him in the coalition talks, because he could leave one of them out if he wants in theory. But we'll have to wait and see. We really don't know. As far as what some of the points of contention will be in coalition talk, first of all, there's the defense ministry, which I talked about. There's also the education ministry. Netanyahu said a couple of times over the course of the campaign that he wants Likud to keep the education ministry, but the Union of Right-Wing Parties also wants the education ministry. So that will probably come up in coalition talks. The Union of Right-Wing Parties also wants the Justice Ministry. And there's at least one senior person in Likud, Yariv Levin, who's very close to Netanyahu. He was a tourism minister for the past few years. He's really been eyeing the Justice Ministry, especially now that, you know, there's a chance that Ayala Chaked won't be back in the Knesset at all. So those are some of the ministries that will probably really be up in the air. I also saw a news item this evening, haven't had a chance to check up on it, that the Attorney General said it might be a problem for Aryeh Deri to be a minister, because there's a law that says that if a minister is indicted, he or she has to resign. And Aryeh Deri is in the same sort of pre-indictment stage as Netanyahu is, where there's an indictment recommended, but it's pending a hearing, so he's not officially indicted yet. But the law only says that a minister has to resign. It doesn't say that a prime minister has to resign, so Netanyahu can remain prime minister after being indicted and throughout the whole process up until the point, if it happens, that he is convicted after appeal. And that's another thing, actually, in coalition talks, the talk right now is that Netanyahu is going to ask all his coalition partners to commit to staying with him after, even if he's indicted. So, again, this isn't confirmed yet. We don't have official negotiations. We don't have, they haven't drawn up papers. But that's what some of the other parties are saying that they're hearing from people in Likud. And that sort of brings us to why nobody's really talking about a national unity government, a coalition that would just be Likud and Gantz's Blue and White Party together. There's no chance that Blue and White would agree to something like that. Lapid has been speaking out against Netanyahu's, alleged corruption for years. They brought this up in the campaign. Netanyahu just wouldn't take the risk, really. Have a party that if he's indicted, they'll just leave and then his coalition will fall apart. And tonight, Blue and White conceded the election after last night they gave a victory speech. They only looked, it seemed, at one of the exit polls. So really, there were exit polls on four different channels and really only one of them showed a possible path to victory for Gantz. But in any case, tonight they conceded. They said they're going to sit in the opposition. Yair Lapid said they're going to make Netanyahu's life miserable. So that's a dramatic start for them. And that is more or less where we are and what we can look forward to in the next few weeks.
Well, thank you very much, Lahav. There's a lot to digest in what has happened and in what you're telling us. We have some questions from our audience, which I'd like to turn to now. First is from Francine Gordon in New York, and her question focuses on an issue that is really important to most of the people on this call, and that's the Israel-diaspora relationship and how that's going to fare under this new government. We're hearing that the government that you expect to be formed and that everyone is reporting is likely to be formed is largely going to be along the same lines as the current government, perhaps even leaning more to the right. And the question here is, what happens to something like the Kotel agreement? And just generally, what's your impression of where things are going to go with respect to Israel-diaspora relationships?
I hate to say it, but I don't think that I don't think there's a lot of hope for a positive change sort of in the government policies or actions, because not only are the ultra-Orthodox parties going to remain in the coalition, but they're actually larger than they were. So they now have 16 seats. There's also now the Union of Right-Wing Parties. They don't have Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked, who were always the moderates in Bayud, and they're actually much more I guess, religiously stringent. They represent a much more religiously stringent branch of religious Zionism than before, and are likely to basically go along with what the Haredi parties want. And so that gives you 21 seats in the coalition that are going to, you know, oppose the Kotel agreement and probably won't, you know, seek changes. I mean, how conversion is treated, and there are a whole bunch of other religion and state issues that are, you know, really just affect Israelis more than the Israel diaspora relations. But I expect religion and state issues to be a battleground in the coming years. Lieberman has spoken out and come out against different moves by the Haredi parties to sort of change the status quo on religion in their direction. But, you know, he was a small party in the last stuff, and he's a small party now, and he's sort of been overruled. But if we focus on the Kotel agreement and the Israel diaspora relationship, the Kotel agreement, I just don't see any way that there's going to be any sort of change or progress on that front because of the power of the ultra-Orthodox parties. You know, in practicality, they did expand the egalitarian section, or they started working on it. I'm not sure of the exact status as of today. But as far as, you know, having a joint committee with representatives of the conservative and reform movement, I just don't see that happening because people see that as a de facto recognition of those movements, and the ultra-Orthodox parties very strongly oppose that. In other areas of Israel diaspora relationships, you know, chances are Netanyahu will still be sort of the go-to person and doing whatever he's done up until now on that front. I find in general that Israeli politicians, they don't quite understand the situation. They don't quite understand diaspora Jewry or American Jewry, and they often need to learn. There are missions to the U.S. from the Ruderman Foundation and things like that that, you know, I'm trying to teach them about the value of that relationship. And that works for members of Knesset. You know, Netanyahu's not going to be prime minister, defense minister, and foreign minister. So depending on what portfolio he holds, it seems at this point he'd like to be defense minister in addition to prime minister, and then someone else would be foreign minister. And so sometimes the foreign minister can put more of an emphasis on diaspora relations, and we'll see whether or not there's a diaspora ministry. In recent years, there has been one, but there isn't always one. So those questions are sort of still open.
Thank you. We didn't hear a whole lot during the campaigns about the peace process, and there are indications that there is an expectation that the Trump plan is going to be offered shortly after now. One of the questions that's sort of bubbling around here is how likely is it that the new Netanyahu government is going to follow up on the pledge made by the prime minister with respect to annexation?
So first of all, with the Trump peace plan, it seems like Likud, and then it's probably reflecting Netanyahu's thinking, it's sort of relying on the Palestinians to say no, in a sense where they're like, well, we don't need to do anything because the Palestinians, you know, haven't been speaking to the Trump administration. And so we'll be the good guys. We'll say that we're open-minded, and the Palestinians will be the ones who say no, and then it doesn't matter. So that's sort of part of why I guess it hasn't come up as a big issue, because I think that that's the thinking in the Likud, but I think that there's widespread skepticism that this, you know, peace agreement is going to actually go anywhere. As far as the Netanyahu's annexation talk, you know, the parties on the right, especially by UD, which is now the Union of Right-Wing Parties, but also a very large chunk of Likud, have been talking about applying Israeli law to you know, Judea and Samaria, or to the Israeli towns in Judea and Samaria for years now. It's not a new thing. What's new is Netanyahu's open commitment to doing at least part of it. To some extent, I think people have to realize that it was a last-minute campaign promise. And, you know, politicians should definitely be held responsible for what they say. Like, that's not the argument they're making. But I think that Netanyahu tends to be for the status quo. He doesn't like to shake things up a lot. And I think in this case, it's the kind of thing where he'll probably just let the successor members of his party talk about it a lot and advocate for it a lot. And he won't really let it go anywhere. Because for a move like that, you don't just need, you know, your party, or you don't just need the Knesset. You need, at the very least, support from the U.S., if not more of the international community. So, you know, it's true that Israel annexed the Golan Heights without support for the international community, although that was, you know, in 1981 already, even though it was only recognized now. But this seems much more complicated, and I do kind of think it's a long shot for Netanyahu to do anything anytime soon. There is always a chance of extreme political pressure, and that we'll have to see.
Okay. Our next question is from Jonathan Golden in Boston. Did any cities or regions in Israel have a noticeable change in their 2019 voting as compared with past elections?
Yeah, you know, I haven't really seen such a change. I think people voted sort of very tribally in Israel, very much the way they were expected. I think it's interesting to see towns near the Gaza border, for example. From the things you hear in the news, from the fact that there's a lot of rockets being shot from Gaza into those areas in recent weeks, you might think that they would all be sort of frustrated with the situation and want to change. But in the end, people voted on very familiar lines, which is that the cities in those areas, which are largely sort of working class, they continue to support Likud, as they traditionally have for a long time. And then the kibbutzes and moshavs in that area voted for blue and white, but in general, they vote for the left. I think that you see that in a lot of other towns as well, just the sort of whatever the stereotype is, whatever they've been voting for a long time, they continue to vote for it. I didn't really see any outliers.
Okay. And our last question comes from Alan Gale of Detroit. Is there a chance for any electoral reform, such as raising the mandate threshold further and creating electoral districts and things like that, particularly in light of what you've told us about certain of the parties not meeting the threshold or coming very close to missing it, such that some very well-known names might not be in the next government?
So nobody really campaigned on electoral reform this time, even though in the past, in the recent past, there have been elections where it was more of an issue. So nobody was really talking about it this time. So I don't have a great answer for that. There are parties that have it in their platform. Yisrael Beiteinu, for example, does have electoral reform in its platform. Netanyahu has spoken sort of approvingly of various electoral reforms before, but hasn't, again, this time hasn't made any kind of promises or indication that that's something that's on the table for him. As far as raising the threshold further, you know, there were so many issues about parties and will they pass the threshold or not and what that will mean, and so much uncertainty before this election because of the threshold having been raised before the last election, before the 2015 election, that specifically doesn't sound like something that's going to happen anytime soon. But, you know, just because someone didn't campaign on something doesn't mean it won't happen, doesn't mean that they won't bring it up in 6 months.
Understood. Thank you very much, Lahav. I'm pleased to call now on Cheryl Fishbein from the to close the conference call.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Lahav, for that really helpful presentation and analysis. Israeli politics can be confusing and complicated at the best of times when we watch it here from the United States. And your briefing today goes a long way to helping us all understand what is happening and what is likely to occur in the coming weeks. So many of us watch this election very, very closely, as we watch any major development in Israel to which we feel so connected. We are intrigued to see how everything will play out, and it certainly promises to be an interesting time coming up, and we anticipate many, many further developments. Thank you again to Lahav and to all of you for joining us. Wishing you all a happy, sweet Pesach. Thank you.
Thank you. This does conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect.